everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started with the last session of today, which is the unveiling of the 2013 Horizon Report. We are going to do this similar to how we did it last year, where we have a short introduction and overview of this year's Horizon Report with Larry Johnson, CEO of New Media Consortium. And then we're going to take audience questions after that. We've got Rebecca Peterson from edX and Audrey Waters, blogger from Hack Education. And then we'll go ahead and just launch right into it. So we've got folks standing by to take questions from the online audience, and we do have microphones out here. So please feel free to just come on up after we're done with the opening and just start asking questions. All right, thanks. And with that, I'll turn it over to Larry.
Thanks, Veronica. Ooh, it's a little static electricity in there. Hi, everybody. And thank you for being here to help us kick this off. This has grown to be quite a tradition. This is the eighth time we've done this, working with ELI. Actually, we started when it was the National Learning Infrastructure Initiative, NLII, was when we started working together to do this report. And now, 8 years later, it's come quite a ways. And so we're really excited to be here back again. I want to start off by sharing with you the official Twitter tag for the Horizon Project. And so if you're sending out tweets, we'd love you to add that tag on the end, and it'll go out to a community of several thousand people that are waiting to have the report. It just was released earlier today. Already there's articles in all the press and everything. It's just, we never used to get any press. And now it's like we have to manage the whole day around it. It's kind of sobering and fun all at the same time. Before we get too much into the report, I want to do some thank yous. And at the top of my list, I want to thank Malcolm and Veronica and all the folks at EDUCAUSE, Diana and everybody that have been supporters of this project and saw value in it. All this time. We really couldn't do it without the participation of the members of ELI, all the great projects that you submit to us to be in the report. It's been, in my view, one of the best collaborations that I've been a part of in my whole career. So I really do sincerely want to thank all of you and everyone that works at ELI for all your help. I would be remiss if I also didn't thank Hewlett-Packard, HP, actually their corporate philanthropy office, the Office of Sustainability and Social Innovation, helps to pay, they fund a big piece of the Horizon Project, not only the Horizon Higher Ed edition, but the K-12 edition as well, so a big shout out to them. And to several members of the advisory board. I saw Richard, I know Wendy's here. Who else is on the advisory board? If you could stand up, I saw Joan Lippincott earlier. There we go. Yeah, so we have quite a few folks represented here. The Horizon Report is their work. We had this year a group of 51 experts that helped us to identify the trends and challenges that are featured in the report and ultimately the technologies that we wrote up. And their contributions and input is absolutely critical to the project, and so thanks to all of you. And then a special shout out to my colleague Samantha Adams Becker. I still stumble over that because she just got married. She used to just be Samantha Adams, and it was simpler. But Samantha is the lead researcher and writer on the report. She took on that role a couple of years ago, and she's just really grown into it really nicely. Just a little bit of background. This slide shows sort of graphically how the report has grown. It started off with a single report in the first few years, and we are today publishing the 29th edition of the Horizon Report. It's been translated 38 times into 10 different languages, and we are negotiating, actually at the end of negotiations, we're not quite ready to make a formal announcement, but close enough for me to share it with you, that we're working with the European Commission to do European version of the Horizon Report, and that's going to take it to another 27 languages. So we're getting it out there, which is really kind of nice. The work is truly global. We're looking at higher education. We look also at K-12, and we also look at informal education via the lens of museums. But our technology outlooks have grown to be a huge piece of research, and we're doing two or three of them at any given time, really. We're doing Australia right now, even as we're doing K-12, even as we're launching this one. But we do annual reports for Australia and New Zealand. For Latin America, that's done completely in Spanish. In Brazil, which was a Portuguese project. Singapore and Asia, we've done one for the UK. We're working with the European Union to do one to be released there for higher ed in the fall. And on the long-term horizon, looking out to parts of Africa and to India to also do technology outlooks. So we're beginning to really start to get a feeling about how technology uptake is working around the world, and it's really kind of cool. There's a couple of tools that I would like to share with you how you can keep up with that, because behind all of that work is a research staff that looks continuously at hundreds and hundreds of publications every single day. We have this amazing reader program that spits out 40 or 50 interesting articles every day, and our research teams go through them. Once a week, they publish the top 10 to an iPhone app called HZ News. We have decided to drop that down to virtually nothing, so watch that space, although it is available today. And if you're interested and you don't use an iPhone or an iOS device, we're releasing the Android version of that app, announcing it today. You can actually download it today if you're willing to be part of the beta test at go.nmc.org/droid. That's going to be free. And officially released on Valentine's Day. So if you're looking for that extra something special to buy your sweetie, consider the HZ News app. Yeah. You can laugh, but you know, I know some of those gals really would appreciate it. all right, back to the 2013 report, which they handed out at the door. On the cover of it is a MakerBot 3D printer, which is part of it. We'll get into what the technologies are, but I wanted to tell a little of the backstory because you have the report in your hands. It's officially available at this URL. It's also available on EDGECAUSE ELI site. Please share that URL with your friends. But if you're interested in the larger story, and I think this is where it really gets interesting. We look at a group of about 60 different technologies and consider actually even a couple dozen more than that, but we are officially tracking about 60 technologies all the time. And the discussions around those technologies and why they're interesting and why they might be important are really rich. And they're completely open and transparent, as the project is. And so I encourage you to look over the shoulder of the advisory board to see the work in there. Even though only six get printed in the report, we actually look very, very carefully at a dozen, which I'm going to share with you in a little bit, as well as more than 20 or 25 trends and challenges. And for a group like this, I think what got left on the cutting room floor may even be more interesting to you than the stuff that there's broad agreement on, because there's some really cool stuff out not very far from here. We always present a Wordle. I was amazed today how hard that was going to be to do, because it requires a 64-bit version of Java. And I don't know if you've been reading the news, but Apple's got this thing going on with Oracle, and to get a Wordle out was a bit of a work, but we did it, and so there it is. I hope you appreciate it. Just figuring out how to which browser to use and how to get the right thing and all of that. But anyway, the key thing about this Wordle is that learning is really what it's all about. Learning in students, university students in particular, that's the focus. of the Horizon Report. We could be writing about financial systems or learning management systems or safety management systems or all sorts of other sorts of technologies, but the Horizon Report's about learning. And that's why it's a good partnership with ELI, because that's what you have learning as your middle name. I want to highlight just a couple of trends that are out there. Of course, MOOCs were listed in the near term in the report this year. Last year, they weren't even on the list of technologies that the advisory board looked at for higher ed. They did appear later in the year, and the first time they were in the report was last September, and now it's just February, and they've gone all the way from the far term to the near term. Of course, you know, there are a great many things that you could say about all that, and we'll probably talk about some of them when we get to the questions, which don't forget questions soon, because I've only got a few more minutes here. At the top of the list, and these are in rank order, and you can look in your copy of the report to read them a little easier, and there's more detail on them. But the one that interests me the most is the top one, openness. We've been talking as a community, all of us, about open content and open data and open educational resources and all that sort of stuff for years. There are major projects in all of those areas. But what has become interesting about an openness is about how it's become kind of muddled up with notions of transparency. That, you know, that projects should be transparent, data should be free, data should be shared. Not only that, but, you know, the access needs to be simple and easy and free and all of that. This is becoming less of a trend and more of a value, especially around in other parts of the world. It's very, very clear that openness is very much at the core of the educational philosophy. I think it's a great trend. The third one on the list targets informal learning experiences and the importance of those in the workplace. Related to that, other workforce demands that we've been tracking are working in teams and working collaboratively. And I'll share a little story a colleague from HP shared with me. He said, you know, we go to the top universities in the world and look for the brightest and the best students from the best programs that we can find. We want to hire the smartest workforce that we possibly can. And so they go to all of your schools and they recruit. But he says, you know why we fire people? We fire them because they can't work in teams. Because they are not culturally aware or sensitive, and it just causes problems in being able to organize efforts that way. I thought that was very, very interesting. Lots of interest in data, and the interesting thing about learning analytics and the focus on big data and small data, for that matter, and even clickometry, as one of our colleagues called it, is this science is starting to come together now. We've been thinking about it for several years, but there have been research efforts underway to really invent new statistics, new ways of thinking about social connections and credibility and how to discern whether students are thinking critically and by mining their comments and their posts and online experiences. That work is really getting to be very, very interesting. And it's still in the midterm horizon, learning analytics, but I think it's going to be something really that's going to come open and really come into play very soon. And one reason is because of all the attention on online learning that's going on. That gives it a perfect place to start, to flourish, to begin to be thought of, and there's a lot of people looking at that space. Meanwhile, we also look at challenges because while the trends are driving our decisions, the challenges are limiting them somewhat. So these are the six that were highlighted by the experts. And mostly what I think they reflect is that we seem to be playing catch-up an awful lot these days. We know that scholarship is moving ahead of our ability to assess it for promotion and tenure. You know, what comprises a digital skill set is a moving target all the time. The demand for personalized learning, we don't have the tools yet to really begin to deliver that the way that the vision is for it. And then all around us, alternative models of what we do. Those are important, and it's important that we continue to think and talk about them and to work on them. But I think the fact that we're a little lagging in these is really also a reflection that some of these challenges really just do require a lot of thought. And we need to think deeply about them. We need to solve them in the right way. They're not just things that we can just throw money at. They're tough problems to solve. So I encourage you to think about that. In just another minute or so I've got, so I'm going to kind of jump into the things that everybody wants to talk about. These are the technologies to watch. And I highlight, I've talked about MOOCs a little bit already. 3D printing was in the very first Horizon Report in 2004. But it focused on the big, you know, $35,000, $40,000 rapid prototypers, you know, that you would see in manufacturing environments or things like that. It's back in the report now because it's coming up from the grassroots through the maker communities. In fact, they're even, the reason why there are cheap 3D printers is because of the maker community. They made them. And then someone decided to sell them for a fairly reasonable cost. And so I think that that's going to be a really interesting space. Like we can think of all sorts of applications for simple technology to render things in 3D. And then lastly, this was Sam's favorite technology of the list. It's been on the list for the whole time that she's been at the NMC, and she's been really trying to cheer along to make the list. And it did this year because of things like flexible screen technology and the fact that sensors and wireless transmitters and things like near-field communications are really making it possible to think about embedding technology actually in articles of clothing, gloves that allow you to expand your sensory capacity or to protect your sensory capacity while you're examining things that might be hot or acidic or something like that. Now, I wanted to show this chart, and I'm going to apologize for the how small it is, but I'm going to guide you through it. The middle column is the current report, the one that's released today. The left-hand column is the museum edition of the Horizon Report that was released in November. And the right-hand column is the K-12 edition that was released in June. And so in one slide, we really have kind of a snapshot of what the entire realm of education is looking at in terms of educational technology. And I've highlighted some in orange. In the near term, every sector is looking at what to do with mobile apps and tablets, and that whole space has just been a flurry of activity these days. In the midterm, game-based learning. Everyone is looking at gamification, game-based learning, and what to do with that. Augmented reality in two of the three. Museums are very active in augmented reality. They're doing some amazing stuff with it. But it's also very important in higher ed, more on the research side in higher ed, more on the wow side in museums, but still very important. And then out, you know, further along, even in K-12, augmented reality is on the list in 4 to 5 years, so it hits all three sectors as well. Two of the three are natural user interfaces. K-12 and museums are both looking at things like that, and there have been some phenomenally interesting new exhibitions opening up that in museums, in particular the Cleveland Museum of Art, I'll highlight as one that is making great use of NUI. And then wearable technology, both in museums and higher ed. So there you go. My final slide is just how can you play? Well, first off, you've learned the easiest way. Just follow that tag, NMCHZ. You'll get a steady stream of links to cool projects, research reports, news about, you know, what we're doing. But mostly that's a community around the Horizon Project. Still active. The same tag works anywhere you can put a tag. So Dig, Delicious, all of those use that tag. We encourage you to comment on the report, both positive and suggestions for improvements and things we might have missed. We follow that religiously. It is really something very important to us. If you want to join in the Facebook crowd on it, just look under the Horizon Project there. You want to be on the advisory board. We're always looking for experts. We replace a third of them every year. So there's usually at least 15 slots open up. Put your name in at go.nmc.org/horizon-nominate and you'll be on the list. Submit your projects, the same URL, /projects. If you would like to see your work or your colleagues' work featured in the Horizon Report, that's one of the best ways to get it to us. We'll be following it. So it was 4 minutes over. I'm sorry. Let's move to questions.
Thanks, Larry, for that opening. So the first thing that occurred to me is that informal learning is a key trend in the report, and that means that there's a lot of informal learning both within higher education and also outside before and after. So when you think about the technologies, how do you think they might build capacity for informal learning?
Bringing the MOOC perspective in, I think we have a lot of learners experimenting right now, not necessarily just from a credit base, which has captured the interest of a lot of in higher ed, is what could we do from a credit perspective. But we have a lot of folks engaging in these MOOCs, at least at edX. We have anywhere from preteens to folks in their 80s globally interested in these courses. And I think that is a huge, and I think it's a huge sign that people are interested and curious about not only extending their education maybe from a skill base, but also just curious inquiry. And I think that's pretty healthy, and we're seeing that in the MOOC space, definitely.
Yeah, I'm really interested in the maker movement and maker culture in particular. And it's very striking to me that this exuberance that we're seeing right now in the maker culture is decidedly outside of the school setting. And so to me, I have to wonder what are we doing? What are we doing wrong in school that would make people reluctant learners there, and yet give them these opportunities in informal settings, and they're quite excited to tinker and play and explore. I'm giving a talk on Wednesday about maker spaces on campus, and I've been talking to various schools who've been experimenting with maker spaces, one of the things that they say is that students are very hungry for these sorts of opportunities. To the 3D printer is pretty much the coolest. I've never been so excited about little plastic things in my whole entire life. But students are very excited to play and experiment, but yet they've been sort of enculturated to be concerned about credits and to feel as though, how does this informal learning, even though we might be able to say, yes, it's inquiry driven, you're tapping into your own curiosity and your love of learning, students wonder, Will I get a grade for this? And so I think that's one of the things that we're going to have to struggle with when we think about informal learning, is just the way in which schooling, I think, makes us value things that maybe aren't about the love of learning.
So, if I could add a point to that, I think that's so dead on, and I'm reminded of a story that Ken Robinson tells a lot, that you go into a classroom of first graders and you ask them, how many of you can draw? Everybody in the room raises their hand, you know? And if I were to ask the same question in this room, let's try it out. How many of you can draw? All right, this is a very creative crowd, but still, you know,
this is the online learning
70% of you didn't raise your hand because you somehow along the way learned that you couldn't draw, you know? And I think the maker community is an expression of, well, wait a minute, I can draw. Mm-hmm. You know, I may not ever be a famous artist, but I enjoy it. I want to make things. I want to be part of that kind of thing. I think that's a very good expression.
I think failure failure is something that when you're building and hacking and making and something doesn't work out and you fail, the stakes are really different than if you sort of experiment in your, you know, Shakespeare class and you fail.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think that we think of failure in very different ways.
And from the online perspective, I think we have a lot of folks, you know, who maybe have been closet technologists or kind of tinkering, like I know a little bit of programming or some of the STEM courses that we're testing out, that this is a very safe entry point, and in a very, what we find communities are driven in the discussion boards and students find ways to connect with others even locally. So I think it is a very safe and kind of entry point for folks to see what else they want to explore more formally.
Mm-hmm. So I think you're all talking a little bit about with the impact of you know, informal learning and the MOOC and some of these other technologies like learning analytics could make for a more informed, more independent learner who comes to higher education a little bit differently than they used to in the past. How do you think all these things might, maybe not today or tomorrow, but in the future, shape the learner? How might the learner change over time?
I'm just always reminded, I had a roommate in college that changed her major like 4 or 5 times in a 3-year span. And I was going to a small private liberal arts college, and her parents basically had her transfer to the state university because it was cheaper to do that kind of experimentation until she found her way. And I do think of that also for, I think, students who sometimes come right out of high school and they're not sure what they want to do. There are these new and emerging opportunities that I think students, whether as they're coming out of high school or coming back to school, can explore a lot of different topics on their own, or some of the things that we're exploring back in Boston, now are community-based. We announced Boston X in the last week, so through community centers and other local organizations, people getting together and trying these courses. And I think has the potential to help learners figure out a little bit clearer where they want to be as they enter college. And we know that there's a lot of stress on time to completion and the costs of college, and there's a potential niche that, you know, MOOCs or other types of online and informal network learning can serve here.
I think that we live in an extraordinary time to be a learner. I mean, there are so many opportunities to, whether it's to take MOOCs or to, you know, to have access to all sorts of literature on and offline. I think one of the challenges right now is that it just seems to be the sort of highly motivated student who does well in that environment. And I think our challenge is to help other learners sort of gain the confidence to be that, to find what they want, what they love to learn, to support them in ways so that they can feel that they can sort of follow their intellectual curiosity. Because, you know, there are so many opportunities, but right now it seems to me that a very privileged few who are able to sort of take full advantage of that. So I think we need to do better with some of the support pieces around our learning opportunities.
You know, in many ways, humans are learning machines. I mean, we can't help but learn. We're learning all the time. You learn about things you like, things you don't like, things you might be interested in. It's just, you can't really turn it off. Where we talk about, you know, where the challenges are is when we try and get people to learn in this very particular kind of way that we call school. And, you know, I think that some of the things that you were just talking about illustrate that, in fact, the amount of choices that we have has really made informal learning become a very interesting space, because it allows the freedom of how you can learn the best way you want to learn.
So we often hear that from institutions that, you know, investing in R&D and some of these technologies, especially some of them in the farther out horizons, it's very expensive to, you know, to have a stake in that space. And we often hear the question, you know, what problem are you trying to solve? And some of them don't neatly fit into a problem. So how do we make the case that this is something we should put time and money into, and people's time and faculty time? How might we make the case for something? Where should that case be made?
I think we have to find the time, we have to find the money. I mean, that's sort of like a lousy political answer, but we have to find the time. And I think that the expertise that those of us that work in education, those of us that have been thinking and doing this for a long time, we have a great deal of expertise, and I worry oftentimes that we're seeing some of this be outsourced beyond our field, particularly to companies that sort of want to profit and aren't necessarily as interested in sort of the mission of teaching and learning as educators and educational institutions are. So I think we have to find the time for research, and I think that we have to perceive this as sort of as scholars of teaching and learning, and not just as sort of as market opportunities for cool new technologies.
To build on that, I think, you know, we get asked a lot, like, what from the MOOC perspective, or my years being a director of academic technology, was always in search of solving a problem, or can this technology do X? And really, to clarify that conversation on campus, I'd often point back to what's our mission, what's our direction, you know, who are we as an organization, to kind of give us the touch points and, like, to clarify where do we want to spend our time. So not only in pursuit of solving a problem, but are we honoring kind of who our focus and who we are as an organization? Because we often can lose that in the conversation or getting caught up in the next big wave. And so if you're not really clear on where you're going or who you are, I think it's very easy to kind of get lost in this and not have a clear direction, and that's where people feel a lot of stress and confusion on what they should be doing as an organization.
So looking at the technology list again, I think I can see that there's a pretty big impact in the instructional side of the house for some of them, but also I see that things like big data and learning analytics really call for very specialized expertise. Areas that maybe today we don't have the kind of expertise that we need to really become active in those areas. So what are your thoughts on how it might change kind of the, you know, the support we have internally and also maybe the instructional role or the faculty role? Do you see a move towards disaggregation or, you know, shifting in support? How might that look?
I'll jump in. Already, several companies, including Dell, have announced that they're going to become providers of learning analytics as a service, which I think is a very interesting development. The fact is that people understand the potential of learning analytics. There are a lot of people in this space that would like to be the solution provider for it, because whoever gets it well has got a bit of a perfect storm, because we don't typically have that expertise in the folks that support educational technology. It lives out in other areas of the university, but typically it's not something that that we have any real experience with. We're going to need some help for it. I don't think that the solutions are going to necessarily come from our communities, and I'm saying, well, there's somebody out in the audience right now that is probably doing something really cool, and I'm gonna be eating my words by the time we get to the reception. But yeah, I hope so too. And if you are, come talk to me, because I'm very interested in this space. But you know, it highlights another challenge that's related to this, because I've had colleagues come up and talk to me that have been in our business for a long time, and they're at the twilight of their careers, and they're going, I think we're at the end of EdTech. You know, I think EdTech, you know, the need for, as we see, devices get smaller and simpler, and, you know, they don't come with instruction manuals, and software is something you buy for 99 cents, and, you know, that, you know, have we done the, I have my own opinion about it, which is, well, there's plenty of work left to do, don't worry, come back tomorrow, we'll be able to fill your day. You know, it is an interesting time that traditional faculty support units are facing with the new opportunities that we have, and also a refocusing of where our efforts ought to be.
I mean, prior to coming to edX, I've always worked in the instructional design and academic technology side, and so in the recent, like the last year, conversations with colleagues on what is instructional design and what is EdTech. So to your point, Larry, I don't know even that we're at the end, but we're reimagining and rethinking that. But that emphasis on really the learning and teaching. And for those of you that may have been at the annual conference for EDUCAUSE here in Denver in November, I found that as a theme that came out of many conversations where people were seeing this shift in not so much focus on the tool and what the tool could do for you, but the tool being more agnostic and really talking more about what the solution, what are we going towards? And I think there's an opportunity to really rethink, well, who are the groups that are supporting faculty and what is it that where we're headed? But I also think we need to still shift that the groups that do support the faculty aren't just supporting, the help desk. I think that's always been a struggle of like so much emphasis on the technology, but not so much the
learning and teaching around it. So I do see that shift, but I'm curious, like you are, if there are other conversations in the room of people really kind of rethinking in their organizations, what is the team that you have and who are supporting your faculty? I think the dream job or the dream position I always wanted until I got to, you know, I wanted for my team as a learning design analyst that would take big data and look at the analytics of things that were going on and then working with institutional research and kind of apply that, you know, and see how we could do learning design through data. And, you know, I'd be curious if people are going in that direction.
I'm really interested in, I mean, when you talk about capacity that we may or may not have, I think one of the things I'd like to see is to develop our own capacity. I'm really interested in the quantifiable self movement and its connection to learning analytics. And the quantifiable self is this notion that you're sort of tracking, it's mostly associated with health data, but you're sort of tracking your own personal data. So I wear a Fitbit, for example, that tracks the number of steps I take during the day, and you can track your calories, you can track how many floors you climbed, your sleeping
couch. It's wearable technology, by the
way. It is wearable technology. And is there a way that we can sort of think about that as a place to start learning analytics? And it's a sort of in terms of developing the learner's own capacity. So to realize sort of, you get a lot of studying done after 3 cups of coffee, but like once you hit like the 6th cup of coffee, you probably should like not continue to study, and you should go for, actually I don't know, I'm not a doctor, so I don't know if I would say go for a run. But I think the way which we can sort of to put some of these, put the burden, not the burden, but sort of ask all of us to be responsible for our own data analysis. And to me then that also means that the data that we're talking about is our personal data as well. So I'm interested in seeing how we can, you know, how we can develop these tools, of course institutionally, but also ourselves. Of course, that's not big data, because
That's little data.
That's my data. Yeah, I don't need a Hadoop cluster in order to crunch the steps I've taken today.
We have a question from the online audience submitted by Alan Heaps. And his question is, do you think the technology advancements from out-of-school technologies, i.e. libraries and museums, will lead the learning practices in K-16 schools?
Yes.
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, that's not my formal area of expertise. I would think that, yes, so that what we're seeing in our space, you know, we look across, you know, what all the technologies people are using and adapt them in learning. So I would think, yes, that these are going to impact our space, or I would hope to. And that's part of my bias, but I would hope that would impact our space.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we do have another one online. This one's from Ed Gary. This one's off of Twitter. His question is, what collaborative learning opportunities do you envision with corporate partnerships? You want me to ask that again? What collaborative learning opportunities do you envision with corporate partnerships?
Well, I'm involved in a lot of corporate partnerships. I mean, we couldn't do the work that we do if it wasn't for our relationships with some of the key companies, and we work with all of them, which is interesting because we have to be Switzerland, you know. But, it's very easy to collaborate. I just think, you know, we were on a call earlier this morning planning a project that we're doing with Brazil, and then HP was on the phone, and it's just that's how they get their work done. I think we actually can learn a lot from the way that global corporations approach getting projects done, because any given day you may be in the morning on a work team with, well, imagine projects, you know, companies like that work on projects 24 hours a day. So you'll be working on it, and the outcome of your work day is the input for, you know, somebody a little further around the globe and so forth all the way through the day. And so then by the time it comes back around to you, you know, two other groups of people have already put full work days in it on it, you know, and you're 3 days ahead. It's kind of an interesting world we live in.
From the MOOC space, just something to watch more. I don't have like a defined answer, but one of the things that we rely on, and particularly for an open online course, is openness with textbook access. So a lot of the things, you know, that we discuss, and as we adapt new courses on our EdX platform, something very important to us is working with the publishers to make available an ebook or a digital copy for free to the students. And those are, you know, conversations that I'm not directly in the room on, but I know that those are very involved in trying to negotiate those, you know, guidelines and partnerships are still evolving. And I would say it's something to look more at in the next coming months or year on how those emerge.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a long tradition. I mean, there's a very long tradition of research partnerships between academic institutions and corporations, particularly in science and technology, and I guess and the naming of football stadiums are probably the ways in which we work together most often. But I think that corporations we hear a lot of pushback. I think that universities aren't necessarily preparing students for the 21st century workforce, and I think that I would like to see sort of more from corporations on exactly what that means. I thought your comments about firing people who couldn't work in teams was really interesting, considering the way in which academia does still sort of depend on students working a lot alone. And when we work together, sometimes that's called cheating. Mm-hmm. And so, I do think that there are ways in which we need to sort of do a better job sort of navigating what our expectations are for both institutions.
I remember being in a class when I was getting my MBA, and the professor looked out at us and said, two of you are going to make A's. You know, so, of course, I thought, well, I wonder who the other one is. But and I found out when I went to the library, we had a required reading list in the library, so I went off to go do my readings, and the other A had been there ahead of me and had cut the pages out of the journal. And you know, and you wonder why we had a banking crisis, you know.
So I'm thinking back to what we heard Vince Tinto say this morning about kind of reminded of back to basics, you know, what really makes a difference in students' lives are relationships and faculty members talking to students, checking in early, things like that. And I, looking at some of the technologies, I think there's some real potential to address some of those, but others, I'm struggling to see some of the connections. Where do you think maybe either direct or indirect connections of things we might learn, where do you think some of those might be to address underpreparedness or motivation or retention, things like that?
I think I think it's really interesting, especially I was fascinated but not surprised to see MOOCs appear on the Horizon report this year, considering that they weren't sort of on the horizon before. And I have to wonder if what we see with MOOCs is sort of a collection of a lot of different trends. But one of them is this great desire to learn together online. And there's something about networked learning, this opportunity right now to learn with anyone, anywhere in the world, that is incredibly powerful. I mean, I think that learning is social, but I think that there's some really exciting opportunities that MOOCs sort of reflect with really sort of making it incredibly obvious that what we do when we learn together is social. And I mean, I think then when things fall apart, it's obvious that the social piece wasn't necessarily there as well.
I think we're also still in very much early days of MOOCs, though it doesn't feel like it. In Silicon Valley time we're not, but yeah. I think in higher ed time we're moving at the speed of light for us. But I think it's still early days, and one of the more, I think, promising and exciting things on the horizon for MOOCs is this adaptation or blended approach to, you know, the fact that people can take a lot of these MOOCs on their own, in a community, work as global learners, but also the potential now that we're seeing other institutions adapting existing MOOC courses to an on-campus implementation. So there's been a little bit of press around work that San Jose State University has been doing. A project that I'm personally involved in at edX is our adaptation of an MIT course that was offered in the fall as a MOOC to two local community colleges in Massachusetts now. So I think it's what happens when you take the really big and massive, and then you can maybe personalize and then adapt it in a blended learning setting that I think has a lot of potential and promise.
I think this whole notion of learning being social is something that we have overlooked in the last 100 years to our detriment in some ways. I mean, there certainly have been efficiencies of scale in the models that we have, and we've accomplished a great deal as humankind in that period. But The fact is that in informal learning, it's almost always something that you do with other people. You know, I like to take photographs, and so, you know, when I want to learn about photography, I like to learn about it with other people that are interested in what I'm interested in, you know, and we kind of bond around that, and we learn from each other, and there's not really necessarily always has to be an expert in the room. We just share, you know, the little tidbits that we've learned, and I think about it, and I think, you know, that's how I learn almost everything I know now since I got out of school. That's really how I like to learn. I like to just learn from the people I'm with and share and all that sort of stuff, and it's very natural, almost you know, an archetype in a way. And so the tools online, the ways that we can do it, the gazillions of options that we have to join communities to do that, I think is definitely one of the reasons why people are really interested in MOOCs, because they see it can work. Yeah.
So since we're talking about the MOOC, I can't help but think that, I mean, I think we've seen institutions who really haven't thought much about online learning before think about it now. Do you think that there'll be some positive outcomes as it relates to online learning, not only for the learners, but, I mean, it's a pretty low-stakes situation, right? You don't have to pay for some of them. Some of them are really easy to join. Mm-hmm. You can drop in, drop out. Do you think we'll see more students become interested or build a tolerance or a preference for online learning as a result of the MOOC?
Well, I think we're also at a very different time. You know, over a decade ago, when I personally started getting involved in supporting online learning, you know, the conversations were very much focused in the course development on the non-traditional student, the adult learner, graduate programs. So if you were working full-time, come back to school, and online was your opportunity to do this. And I think what's really exciting right now is the fact that this conversation is across the campus. It's not necessarily only at the, you know, adult learning or the continuing ed division, but we're looking at it as a conversation in the undergraduate and in the residential campus. And so there is this potential to really rethink in, you know, education from a residential model. What does it mean to do a blended learning course that maybe over a decade ago we wouldn't think that our students were prepared for or able to handle? And I think as technology has become more ubiquitous, our students coming up from K-12 are much more fluent and used to, basically, because a lot of their districts do have them having laptops and tablets, and they work in a very digital environment, that they, I think, are more open to these types of blended learning. And I think it's more the institution that has to adapt more quickly to what we're going to start seeing also from our students.
I think it's interesting that we're not just the conversations that we're having about should our institutions move online, but we're actually having conversations about teaching and learning. Mm-hmm. In the ways that I'm not sure institutions necessarily have. Sort of, you know, people tune in to MOOCs for sort of these rock star, superstar professors, and they watch them and they think, wow, that's crap. I think that it's forcing people to really evaluate, like, how are you spending time in class? If you can flip the, if you can assign, if someone else has made videos, if you can assign videos, like, how are you, what are you doing in the classroom? Are you lecturing? Are you just a talking head that offers multiple choice questions at 20 minute intervals? I think that MOOCs are forcing us to have discussions about both what it looks like online and what it looks like in the face-to-face setting, and I think that that's incredibly important, even though sometimes it's really painful.
I actually had an online question that relates to kind of what you said, which was, with all these paths of learning available, how do we know what level the students brings with them to the university, and then how do we change the learning space to meet their needs?
I mean, I think that's part of the excitement of being of the now, and I don't have, you know, my crystal ball can't give a clear answer to that, but I think that is exactly why I think a lot of us are even here at events like this, is when you're occupying the space of supporting, teaching, and learning, this is our job, this is who we are, this is we support our faculty to do what they do best, but also help emerge that model. And I think, I really am curious to be, at this point next year, how much more we will know, and what we'll be able to report on data-wise to answer some of those kinds of questions. I think we have hunches right now, But I like to be more in a position to say definitively, okay, this is what we know.
Well, in the past, many institutions relied on articulation agreements, right? We sent over the curriculum, you know, a faculty member looked at it, we said it was good, and now we know, you know, if you passed the course. But that's all changing. So now we're more focused on what did you actually learn, and so how do we measure that? How do we assess that? I mean, that's going to be very complicated, I think.
Yeah, I think that that's incredibly challenging, and it raises lots of questions, I think, for students and teachers and those of us who are sort of, and people like myself, it's been a long time since I've been in the classroom and thinking, you know, what did I learn in college? I learned a lot of skills, but in terms of knowledge that you would test me on today, oh man, they would revoke my degrees in a heartbeat if I were quizzed on an iota of the information that I purportedly learned.
So luckily, it's all out of date, so no worries.
I keep waiting for the student loan people to like have the clause where they, if you don't pay back your student loan, they take your degree. But that's the Horizon report for another day. Mm.
So we just have a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask kind of a closing question. Looking at the Horizon report, you know, being on the advisory board, there's a lot of stuff that is generated, and of course, only six make it. So what do you think is missing? What challenges do you think we missed, or trends do you think we missed? What would you have liked to seen in there, given that you only had, like, what, 24 hours to... Not even that.
Yeah, we didn't get to reporting yet.
They handed it to you on the way in. You should have read it by now.
I think for me, I think that the 3D printing is part of, as I said, part of the larger maker culture. And I do think that there are lots of trends that are connected to that, the sort of interest all of a sudden in everyone wanting to learn how to code, for example. And I think that that's actually fueling a lot of the interest, of course, in the MOOCs that come from Silicon Valley and from edX as well, is this sort of this a desire for folks who weren't traditionally techies to sort of hone their technology skills. So I would say, and I think that that's loosely connected with the maker movement, but not entirely. So that would be one that I'm thinking that I would say is missing.
You know, and this isn't, you know, the most eloquent articulation, but I'm thinking more of like along the networks, community-based learning lines. You know, how are people doing network learning? How does that overlay through, you know, an existing structure in higher ed or K-12? And I keep thinking of, you know, co-curricular life and the undergraduate model and how undergrads do use a lot of, not just social media, but network in a very different way, and how does that impact? I don't know how you would express that as a tangible theme in the report yet, Larry. I'll work on that. But, you know, just that idea of we see the benefits of networked learning informally in the MOOC environment and also, of course, on campus and student life and development. But what does that mean? And will that actually be a thing, a trend?
So, we think about this all the time, and one of the things that has become really apparent, we've been holding special meetings each January, and several people here were at the retreat that we held a couple of weeks ago, where we really work to try and identify what we call megatrends, trends that are going to be influencing our decisions for 5, maybe even 10 years. And when we think back, actually, it's not that hard to think about some of them. You know, everything's getting smaller, faster, you know, cheaper. Those are long-term trends, and the whole informal learning thing, I think, is a long-term trend. You know, we've put a lot of work into thinking about them, but when you look at the gestalt of the list, there's no technology in there. The long-term trends that are going to be driving our technology decisions are really all social trends. They're all trends that impact the way that we think about how we want to work with each other and how we want to, you know, approach what it is that we do and how that's changing around the world and how the world is getting smaller. And so we began thinking about, is there a way that we could study the trends themselves in more depth so that we could begin to understand in the same way that we try and add a time factor to the technologies that are going to be interesting, could we add a time factor to the trends and the challenges? Which of those are, you know, right here that we need to pay attention to? And which are ones that are going to be out a little way? So watch this space, because we're really trying to think about how to wring a little bit more information out of this work. I think it's an interesting time, for sure.
So are there any questions from the audience? Comments? Want to share before we close out the session? Yes.
So talk about informal learning and a lot of verbiage around that, but one word I haven't heard anybody mention yet, which is not really saying informal learning, is play. That's what people do. Play. Learn when they play. That's the best way to learn. That's the motivation that people have to learn, because they're getting some sort of pleasure out of whatever, you know, electrodes are firing in our brain. The impulses, electrical impulses.
Excellent point. Well, thank you for that. I mean, not expecting an answer part. It's an excellent. It is an excellent point, though, and I'd have to mull on it before I could really.
Yeah, the question was that since learning is becoming more social and more networked, what happens to folks who are more introverts and want to just kind of go alone? You know, do it by, they become computer science people.
No, and then I have to deal with them.
I'm just kidding.
They're all in a move.
So just something to think of. It's a style, right? I guess what we're saying is there's a style embedded in what we're doing.
Yeah. I mean, I have to wonder, too, if some of this, the notions of learning together and learning by yourself, I mean, I think that all of these are, there's so many different factors that could tie into this notion of play and failure and fear. And so, I mean, I think it's hard to, it's hard to unpack sort of why a preference for learning alone, I think, is a very difficult thing to unpack and identify exactly what that means. I'm not trying to sort of psychology profile or anything, but. Yeah.
I had the opportunity to have a conversation with Sherry Turkle the other day, and of course she wrote Alone Together, and her current research is really looking at a very similar question, which is when are you going to get the most bang for the buck for having a social experience online, and when should you put it face to face, and when should you design it some other way? It's an interesting set of questions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was a comment back. Yes. Mm-hmm. Maybe. You know, I think that our understanding of both of them is a little early. You know, I mean, we definitely, if you look at the history of what we've been studying over the last going on 12 years, there's been a lot of convergence all the way through this story of the uptake of new ideas and technology. And so I'm certain there'll be some overlap because a lot of those analytics are going to be coming from social spaces.
I think that there's a lot of interesting things that could be gleaned from social network analysis. So who you're connected to in your learning circles, I mean, sort of who your peers are that you're learning with, who your professors are and how they're interconnected, how the topics that you're learning about are connected, not just sort of intellectually, but how are these topics connected to experts socially as well. So I do think that we'll be able to. I mean, I think that a lot of the learning analytics that I've seen so far are still, as you were saying, they're still very, very basic. I mean, a lot of it is still sort of a computerized version of, did Johnny miss too many classes? Oh, he did. He's going to fail. We should send him an email.
And so I think that we have a long way to go before we're getting to some of the more sophisticated things that we can glean a lot more information about a broader thing than just sort of your grades and your attendance record.
Well, I think one of the other things to consider, there are, you know, some sophisticated ways to look at data, but then we start getting into privacy. When I think of like the social side, and then you want to do the learning analytics side, and you know, you can use that data for good. Then there's some people who consider that the creepy data, you know, that it's tracking everything that you do. And what is that fine line ethically, the nuanced line that we use for good in education, understanding learning, but also allowing people a certain privacy in their social life online, and how that social life kind of bleeds into academic life.
These people look thirsty.
Yes. So I want to thank our panelists for joining us today, Larry, Audrey, and Rebecca.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll move into the reception.